Hello and welcome back to the official Scottish Rugby Podcast. I'm Jamie McMillan. With me, as always, are Rachel Malcolm and Chris Patterson. And our special guests this week are Scottish Rugby officials Sam Grove-White and Holly Davidson. And they join us to talk about their recent appointment for the Olympic Games in Tokyo this summer.
We've sort of been up in the air and then we finally sort of got the confirmation Tokyo is going to go ahead. They are planning on having it, obviously, less fans or no travelling fans.
Yeah, I've been to Japan once before and it was just like no place I've ever experienced before.
Well, joining us on the podcast now is Scottish Rugby's match officials Holly Davidson and Sam Grove-White. First of all, huge congratulations, guys, on being appointed for the upcoming Olympic Games in Tokyo. Holly, I'll come to you first. You must be delighted that you're going to be involved in the Olympic Games, I guess.
Yeah, can't wait to get out there. It's been a while since both Sam and I have been out on the Sevens circuit, but I suppose that just makes you want to get back even more. So yeah, can't wait to get out to Japan and see how we go.
And Sam, how did you find out? When did you find out? Because I know it's been a bit of a weird year because obviously these Olympics were supposed to take place last year. So has it kind of been almost like a year waiting for this, or has it kind of been a bit up in the air? What's been the kind of timeline for you guys?
I guess it's been a bit of both, if I'm honest. So last year we half expected that the group was on the Sevens was going to be going. It was never really confirmed to us or never told. And then it all sort of just started, the season started shutting down as, you know, Corona started kicking off for us all. I think we slowly lost tournaments, started off with Hong Kong, then London, Paris, and then there was hope the Olympics were happening, and then all that disappeared. So all just sort of disappeared at one time. And we then got a couple of other tournaments in. And then this season, we've sort of lost a lot as well. So we've sort of been up in the air, and then we finally sort of got the confirmation Tokyo is going to go ahead. They are planning on having it, obviously, less fans or no travelling fans, but now it is happening. So we found out officially there on Friday. So, you know, great news to finally find out and to have something to look forward to later in the year as well.
And it's been a goal for both of you, hasn't it? Obviously, a lot of experience in the Sevens circuit, but the prestige in Olympics makes that even more special. Was this the Olympics almost, if you like, that you targeted, or when you set out in referee, and this was the one that was going to fit, or the first one that would maybe fit in best with your dreams?
Yeah, I think so. I think my first probably proper viewing of a referee was at the Olympics in Rio 2016. We obviously had Mikey Adamson there from a Scottish perspective. And it's probably the first time I started paying attention to it. And I was like, God, this is amazing. Like, you know, this is something that I'm never going to make it there as a player, but I could make it there as an official. And previous to that, you didn't really see, from my perspective, female officials on the TV with regards to the women's game. So that was the first time I'd seen that as an opportunity. And yeah, like you said, when Sammy and I got onto the Sevens in 2017, and I think it was quite apparent that that was our goal, to have that four-year cycle going into Tokyo 2020. It's just been pushed out a year, but, you know, it's still, yeah, it was definitely a goal of ours.
It's worth waiting for. And Sam, you were saying a lot of experience on that seven circuit. You've already said there's not been any sevens or next to no sevens, certainly at a top level, an exposed level. Have you been doing any sevens training or focusing on sevens stuff behind closed doors to prepare you for that? Or is it just try and get some tournaments between now and then?
I think it's pretty much is that at the moment. We're sort of begging to get tournaments where we can. The best possible, you know, try and hopefully link in with GB at some point, but then being based out in Loughborough, that makes it more challenging. You know, normally Holly and I would be with the Scotland teams regularly. My last time refereeing was Vancouver back in March last year, but we do have there's some warm-up events that have been arranged by World Rugby. So there's the final qualifying tournament in Monaco that both Holly and I are going to, and then a week later, I think there's a tournament in LA that's going to take place as well, just to get the qualified team some exposure and hopefully us some exposure to a bit of seven rugby as well, because I know the players speak about it a lot, but the step up from the speed of a 15s game to a sevens game is just night and day. You know, you definitely have to find yourself a new set of lungs when you do.
Is that the biggest challenge, the fitness or the how quickly you have to be at every breakdown if it's possible? Is that the biggest difference?
I guess, yeah, I think probably the difference in the sevens is that a lot of the breakdown and tackle contests are one-on-one, so the speed of it is so much quicker. You know, 15s, you could probably cruise into a breakdown, you could let a few things happen, blag it, maybe miss the first thing if you really miss it, and you get away with it. Whereas in the sevens, there's just no hiding. And because every decision can lead to a try scoring opportunity, every decision is a big decision. So then you add that to probably the heat where they are, all are, and the speed of the game. It's certainly a challenging aspect to ref.
Not to be funny, Holly, but does it make it easier if there's fewer involved in each contact, in each tackle? A lot of it was so difficult for referees, say in the 15s game, where you've got a process of what you look for first, but there's so many bodies at times coming at different angles at different times. But if it is almost a one-on-one duel in sevens, although it's quick, does it make it easier? Does it make the pictures clearer?
I think so. I think you're right in the sense that the pictures are much clearer. So if your pictures as a referee are correct, it should make it easier. Although if they're wrong, it makes it far more apparent that you've made a mistake. So it's kind of a catch-22. If you're on the button, you're doing a good job. But yeah, you know, there's only 14 players on the pitch. So in that sense, infringements are easier to spot, I'd say. And it's just a quicker... It's just a quicker whistle compared to the game of 15. So, it's different, but also it's a good challenge.
We talked to Chloe Rowley last week, and she's gone back and forth between, 15s, Premiership rugby, then 7s. And it's kind of a little bit what Moss was touching there on. It's, you guys have been doing kind of 15s rugby, and then you're switching to 7s. How, apart from the fitness, how quickly is it that you can kind of slot into that kind of role? Because obviously the games are, it's a game of rugby essentially, but they are very different, the way that they're governed, the way that they're allowed, very different. So how easy is it for, we kind of heard from Chloe from a player's perspective, the challenges, but from a referee perspective, when you've been working, pro 14 games or whatever, now you've got your heading towards sevens, how difficult is that transition?
I think it can be challenging at times. The best way I try and slot between the two is almost immerse myself so much in watching a lot of footage, because you'll move to the sevens and there's kind of like non-negotiables in the sevens, i.e. a deliberate knock-on is pretty much always a yellow card. If there's a penalty and the ball gets thrown away, it's pretty much always a yellow card. And it's actually just remembering stuff like that when you go back into that environment, which can so easily be forgotten when you've not been reffing it for a year. So I find it easy to just watch a lot of games of sevens going into the competition, and vice versa when I go back into 15s, watch a lot of 15s and try and, it sounds so silly, but you just have to have an extra breath at every breakdown to this is not sevens. Take the whistle out of your mouth. You've got time.
Sam, is that a similar feeling for you then, about that transition between the two?
Definitely. I think the sevens, as Holly says, got the different areas of the game that are slightly different. The yellow cards, the kickoffs, being free kicks rather than, scrum options. But also when you go back into the 15s, there's a lot more set piece. So again, you've got to immerse yourself in almost learning what the line-out's all about, what the scrum's about, and almost refereeing that kind of game of chess. Whereas in the sevens, you're just going out, make a decision, get on, you forget about it, and everyone moves on. Whereas in 15s, a lot of decisions you make earlier in the game can have an effect later on in the game. So whereas in sevens, again, you can blag it and you can get on with it and move on. Whereas 15s, if you don't set the right standard early doors, you need to be switched on. So I think it's important that we're watching and getting stuck in early doors and watching plenty of footage to get back into it. Because they are, although both games are rugby, they are very, very different as well.
The one thing I definitely don't miss in the 15s and the sevens, must have been a couple of seasons ago, they introduced the shot clock between a try scored, the conversion being taken and the restart being taken. And it's obviously only 30 seconds. And that sounds probably quite a lot, but when you're running about there and you're in Sydney in 33 degree heat, that 30 seconds goes like a flash. So whereas in 15s, they'd have it in the top 14, but not something that's been introduced yet here in Pro 14.
They were looking at it again. That came up my discussion I was involved in to try and bring that into 15s. I know it is in the top 14 in France. I think it's a great thing. I think it's a good thing. I should know this, but does the countdown clock, is it visible for the spectators who are there? And so do you get a situation where some fans actually count it down? Is it almost build this crescendo for the goal kicker?
It's quite good because they do it as in on the big screen. Your sevens is all about entertainment and fun, so they have it on a big screen. It's around the posts. In Hong Kong one year, they had the post flash red if you were late. So if you didn't get your kick in time, the post just went red and that was completely gone. You've got big noises in the stadium. So yeah, it's great for the players and great for the fans. But when you're sucking air after running 100 metres, you're just begging for that clock to stop and to to maybe find an injured player on the ground that you can get time off for.
I like it. I like it. I think it'd be good as well. Like in 15s, I know it is in France, but it's a minute or 90 seconds in 15s, which is a long time. But right, that 30 seconds is short. And I suppose it has a knock-on effect of some of the try-scoring celebrations and, you know, kind of wasting time, throwing the ball away, taking as long as you can. It does bring that kind of dynamism to the game. I know you guys are involved in 15s as well, as already said, but it would be a welcome thing in 15s, I think. Would you agree?
I agree. I think as well it then makes it less subjective. The fans and the players are very aware of how long a kicker is taking for their kick. Sometimes it can feel like an eternity when a kicker is setting up and they're going through their routine. If there was a clock on the screen for everyone to see, it would make it so easy to say, well, they clearly still have time, or, you know, you blow your whistle and say, no, your time's up. I think it would be great, and it just adds a little bit more like theatre to the whole thing.
And it would eradicate something that Mossy and I have talked about at length in the podcast before, and you referees will know this as well, that creeping into the game is the sub celebrating with players after they score a try in their own warm up area. So if you only get 30 seconds, it might deter that from the bibs getting involved in the celebration. So I won't get your thoughts on that, guys, but I know that it's been talked about probably at length at a number of meetings for a number of years now. Just to pick you up on another point you mentioned there, you talked about Hong Kong, and we all know the Seven Circuit. It's a tremendous thing to be involved in, you know, and even more so as a match official, because you're getting that experience in a really high quality circuit. But from a, you know, your own personal point of view, what is your, you know, where's your favorite destination to go in a normal year, normal circuit? Where's your normal destination to be, and what do you expect from Japan hosting this Olympics that you maybe seen before or that you're looking forward to? I'll come to you first, Sam.
I think, as you said, there's so many good places, it's tough to pick a good one. I think they've all got different areas that are so class. You know, go to Hong Kong and it's just wild all weekend. I remember the first year I was there, they hosted the qualifier for the Seven Seas as well. So you've got all your countries that aren't on the top 16. So you had your Ugandas, your Zimbabwes, and I think it was 9 o'clock on the Saturday morning, and there's the South Stand, which is obviously the infamous party stand that you have to queue in all day to get into, and once you're in, it's obviously one in, one out. And we arrived to warm up for our 9 o'clock match at Hong Kong. I think it was Germany, we were playing Uganda, and the South Stand was full by then. And the announcement comes out, South Stand's full. Like, these two teams have probably never had such a big crowd for a match, but this group are already in the stand ready for a party for the day. So I think that sums up Hong Kong quite nicely, and that's just wild all weekend. But you've got a lot of different destinations. Like Cape Town, South Africa is really nice. Everyone loves going to Australia, but I think my favourite is Vancouver. I think everyone associates the Sevens with the nice weather and the sun, whereas Vancouver, we go in March. It's a different time of the year, so it's a bit average. But, you know, the last time we went up there on our day off, we were able to get up to Whistler Mountain, and we were able to go up into the snow, and we did sort of some climbing in the snow, and then we did the zip lining across the mountains, which was a really cool activity, and it was a good bit of team building with the refs as well, because it was really good fun. A few of the boys weren't as big a fan of heights as others, so it was quite entertaining pushing half them down a mountain. But yeah, just on Canada as well, it's because the stadium's indoors and it's got a roof, it's just a wild atmosphere, and they're a really knowledgeable crowd. Obviously not, they are doing well in the rugby world, but they're not what you'd probably associate as the big rugby countries, but it's just a fantastic tournament there, and it's just a great experience all weekend, and they're there for all the games. You know, you get sometimes like South Africa, you go the big crowd for South Africa, but then the crowds disappear a bit for the rest of the games. Whereas in Canada, they're just there the whole time supporting every match, which is fantastic.
And Holly, you're going to Japan. You know, that's going to be some experience. Excuse me. I don't know if you've been to Japan before, so please excuse me if you have. But what are you looking forward to the most from the Olympics, from the Japanese, or maybe the culture side of things?
So I've been, I've been to Japan once before. There's a woman's leg there in Kitakishu. And it was just like no place I've ever experienced before. I suppose going there, if I'm being perfectly honest, I'm not really sure now, given the situation that the Olympics is in, what really to expect. which in some cases probably makes it quite a unique Olympics to be a part of. We probably won't be there for the opening ceremony. We fly kind of 3 days in before the competition, do the competition and leave straight after. So I think, you know, I think any show the Japanese want to make it as great as possible. Hopefully we'll get a lot of fans into the sevens, and it'll be a spectacle in itself. I think Sammy probably loves Canada because us Scots don't deal too well with the heat out, and I think Japan is going to be toasty. Sydney last year, there was a heat wave when we were there. My body felt like it was like pulsating when we were out reffing. So I expect it to be challenging, like environment-wise. But I expect the experience to be fantastic, and the Japanese to just completely show everyone what an occasion they can put on. You saw it at the World Cup back in 2019. So I'd expect something similar for Tokyo.
Yeah, it was amazing. I was lucky enough to be out for part of the World Cup in 2019. And the one thing I'd say about atmosphere or noise with the Japanese supporters, it was just noise the whole time. Usually you get used to kind of the fluctuations of a cheer or a lull in the game, but there was just this wall of noise for 80 minutes nonstop, and it didn't really die down or go up. It was just noise, and it was completely unique. But the excitement levels and around the game are massive. They're continuing to grow, and this will be absolutely no different.
So moving back to the Pro 14 for a second, I know the Rainbow Cup's going to come into to fruition pretty soon, and you'll have involvement in that. But to go back a little bit, Holly, you finally got your first game away in the Pro 14 a few weeks ago. Just give us your thoughts on that experience, and probably maybe the relief that you finally managed to get out there and do it.
Yeah, you're right. There probably was a little bit of relief to finally get over the line. I'd obviously had two games postponed prior to that. So to finally do it, you know, the saying of getting the monkey off the back, you can now go in and there's probably a little bit less, a little less eyes on you to watch your first one. But I was probably, I was fortunate in the sense that the two teams I was refereeing, you know, they don't want to throw the ball around, play rugby, very positive. So yeah, it was good to get the first one done.
And Rainbow Cup kicks off this weekend. Are you both going to be involved in that over the next few weeks? Now, the big thing around, well, one of the big things around here is we've got some law trials taking place. It's three new law trials, isn't it? There's a goal line dropout for if anyone's held up over the line, or I think if a kick into the end goal area is touched down, a goal line dropout rather than a 5 metre scrum, which I like. I think it'd be brilliant. There's a 20-minute red card. So if there's a red card, there's that player's sent off, but after 20 minutes, the team who's lost the player can have someone else added on, added back to make up a full 15. And the other one is the captain's challenge, where your decisions for the first 75 minutes can be questioned. Is that right? And there for the last 5 minutes, I think anything can be questioned, as far as I read it. Loads to talk about, loads of views in it, different bits and pieces. I suppose, Sam, you're involved this weekend.
Yeah.
How good a study have you had of these new law variations, and do you expect a few instances to come up?
Yeah, so it's been going in New Zealand and Australia for a fair bit, and it's something that we're looking at pretty closely because you know how many laws are in rugby at the best of times, so add a few more into the mix just keeps you on your toes. So definitely been looking a lot. I think it'll be interesting. I think, as you said, the goal line dropout one sounds quite a good idea. It hopefully encourages teams to look for space in the 22 to score the tries rather than picking and going. So hopefully there'll be some good aspects from that.
And also that it rewards good defence, I think. Because sometimes there's some brilliant pieces of defence to prevent a try, get under the ball, hold it up. And not that defending a scrum's a bad result. Obviously, it's a better result than conceding a try, but if you've got the skill and ability and the strength to do that, having an opportunity potentially to win the ball back from a short kickoff, drop out, or go long and clear lines, I think it's a good thing as well.
Yeah, gets away from 5 metre scrums. I think sometimes you get the defence just sort of dig their heels and we're not going to go backwards. The attacker looking for a penalty try when there's never really an option on, and you sort of get stuck in a stalemate. So if it gets us away from bits like that, we get more ball in play, I think it can only be a good thing.
And Ollie, it has to be taken anywhere across the goal line, is that right? Or does it have to be between the posts?
Yeah, I think my understanding is that it can be on the goal
anywhere.
Line. Yeah, I would just.
And it has to probably, go over five, is it?
Yeah.
Over travel, the 5 meter, not the 22.
Yeah. I would probably say though, my only thought on the goal line dropout is when there's a kick into in goal. I understand that it may encourage people to run instead of dot it down, but you're trying to encourage a team to play a ball that is not actually in the field of play. It's gone into in goal. So if it's a rubbish kick and there's a good chase, I don't think the defending team should be penalised for a ball being into in goal. That's, for me, that maybe still should be a 22 drop. Instead of a goal line dropout. But, you know, it's exciting. It's something different. And I think, yeah, hopefully we see a little bit more attacking rugby that looks for the space on the outside.
And just the last one, the captain's challenge. Have you got any strong views or even having seen, you know, some of it in the Southern Hemisphere and touching base? I know you're a strong community, global community of referees. There'll be a few phone calls and Zoom meetings, I think, to see what to expect. But that's it's got to be engaging, that just even to see what happens for fans, for supporters, for coaches, for players, for referees, for officials. It's a big call, but again, I think it's great that these things are trialled, but it's I don't know, what do you expect or what have you heard from your Southern Hemisphere counterpart on this?
I think it'll be an interesting one. I think there could be an art to the good challenge. You know, you saw in the cricket, you know, in the Ashes when Ben Stokes went on to win that game for England, whereas Australia burned a challenge early doors that was on a wicket that was never going to be out. And then when they did get something out that wasn't given out, they didn't have a challenge left and they sort of lost the game because of it. So I think there'll be an art to what the captain challenges and when they challenge. I think like all these things, there'll be a bit of getting used to it for the captains and for us, for what can be challenged, what can't be challenged. Because as you said earlier, I think the first 75 minutes, it's only around try scoring opportunities that can sort of be challenged. And then afterwards, it can be anything. In the last 5 minutes, it's sort of anything that can sort of be challenged. But the one caveat to that is it's non-decisions by the ref. They're not a challengeable item. So if I don't blow my whistle for something other than foul play, that can't be challenged. But if I blow my whistle and you don't agree, that can be challenged. So there's already a bit of confusion around there, even just trying to explain it. But I think it'll be interesting, I think.
Play on then, is it, Holly? Play on.
Jouer. Now, look, I think it is. I think it's, again, it's trying to make it a good product so that the captains feel like they have an opportunity to ask questions that aren't seen in a negative manner. It's building the rapport between the referee and captain. And, you know, like, we're all human. We make mistakes. Mm-hmm. There's things that we miss on the pitch. And if they have, I think especially when it comes to foul play, if they have a case that, you know, can you look at this? And it's not dismissed. I think that is a positive thing. Then we're making sure that we get things on the pitch and they're not potentially being brought up later on by sighting, etc. So I think it'll be totally different. It's another challenge for us as referees to get our heads around, but just with games and experience, hopefully it'll kind of bed in and be a good spectacle for fans and players.
Yeah, I think it's a real positive that we're in a situation now where we're happy to trial. We'll look at trial and engage with supporters, or engage with administrators and players and officials, and you're trying to get the best product out there. I'm getting carried away in this. I'm getting excited already. I'm not kicked off it. But in terms of the process of it, do you all stand together and look at the big screen, or do you?
I think that's the battle, isn't it? You know, you're going to want the captain that's there is going to want to. They're going to want to be a part of the challenge, and then probably the opposing captain is going to want to try and not let you see the challenge. So, I think once the challenge has been made and we've all agreed the terms of what we're challenging, I think we'll go off into our referee group and try and stay strong together and to view that, and then sort of report back what we've seen. Because I know one of the things is a forward pass, and you know, Chris, you do a bit of commentating. I think you know you guys see. What is a forward pass? Like people agree 50-50 down the line on certain ones. So I think naturally there's going to be someone that's going to be hacked off on some of these ones, especially on the forward pass ones. So that will be an interesting one. I think what you're saying about the crowd stuff and what we saw when we're speaking to the guys down south is when they have a TMO interaction, their voice in the TMO goes live to the stadium. And I think that'd be a really cool thing we could do up here when we get crowds back, is that right, it's a captain's challenge, mm-hmm. or we're broadcasting the stadium, and they then feel part of it. Yes, they see the angles normally, but if they could hear and see what was going on, I think that'd be a really good addition to the game, what we do up here, that would just add a bit of excitement, add a bit of theatre, maybe add a bit of noise, but it's not always a bad thing, is it?
You need to put your posh voice on for that, though, to broadcast at 60,000.
I'm from Montrose, I don't have a posh voice.
I, just last spot on the captain's call. Am I right in thinking that if you make a, you know, if I approach you, Holly or Sam, and say, look, I want to contest this, and if it's proved that, you know, in my favour that there is a case, I still then have, I don't lose the right, I retain the right, I don't lose, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It's like tennis. You know, if you have your challenge, if it's incorrect and it's not accurate, you lose the challenge. But if it's proved to be correct and accurate, you keep your challenge.
One more question for you both. You know, it's so fascinating listening to you and hearing about, you know, the transition from 15s to 7s and being part of the Olympics. But, you know, I guess from Scottish Rugby's point of view, you know, you guys are kind of leading the way now in the kind of Scottish rugby referees. And for somebody who's listening and maybe have an interest or wants to be involved, what can they do or where can they go to get more information about becoming a referee? And what advice would you give to somebody who's listening and maybe thinking, do you know what, I want to give this a go?
I think the first place thing to certainly look is the Scottish Rugby website. I think in the community rugby part, there's a big referee section. I know it's certainly going to be getting bigger and better and there's going to be more stuff going on that. Probably the advice I'd say is if you are thinking about it, just give it a go. Maybe there's a lot of not negative perceptions of referees, but maybe it doesn't always look in the best light. If you want to follow out the game, maybe it's better to go and do coaching or do something like that. Who wants to go be a referee? Who wants to get shouted out on a Saturday? But it's certainly not all about that. There's certainly some good, there's some great aspects, I think, both Holly and I have enjoyed through it. You know, we've met a lot of great people, we've traveled to a lot of great places. And obviously that's at the top end of the game, but even at the lower end of the game, you know, one of my favourite experiences is refereeing in Caledonia, which is the sort of north region, and Orkney were in that, and you get to go up to Orkney and referee up there, and it ends up having to be a weekend trip. They look after you again. They're so hospitable. And that's one of the best experiences I've had, and I wouldn't have had that without refereeing. And it's just a great way to be involved in games on Saturdays. You can, there's some really good people involved in refereeing. There's some good opportunities. You can develop as a person, and sort of learn more about yourself as well. There's obviously ups and downs, but it's for me, it's something I would always encourage as many people to get into.
Can you remember your? I assume you will. We've spoken to Holly about this before, but Sam, can you remember the first game you refereed?
Yeah, so I started refereeing sort of when I was at uni up in Aberdeen, and so sort of local games. And the first game I did was Aberdeen Wanderers 2s versus the West Dyce, I think it was at the time, and it was sort of Hazelhead Park, sort of public park where they play at. First game, really nervous to turn up for, no idea where you're going. And look, I'm 28 now, but I look about 18. So can you imagine how young I looked back then? And I turned up, and there was like three or four people just asking, "Are you lost? Are you lost? We don't need a ball boy here," sort of thing today. So there's a lot of that going about. Eventually, found a changing room in a janitor's cupboard or whatever, rather than enforcing with the teams. And that was sort of the first game, plenty to learn. There were some very keen to referee and make sure they knew how good I was, but probably blew far too many penalties. But yeah, that was the first time.
Massive congratulations on the Tokyo 2020 appointment. It's great. You guys are going to be involved in it, and we wish you all the best. And we'll hopefully get you back on just before you go, when you maybe know a little bit more about what games you're going to be undertaking. But Holly Davidson, Sam Grove-White, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast, and we'll speak to you soon.
Thanks so much.
Cheers, thank you.
Thanks, folks.
Well, great to hear from Holly Davidson and Sam Grove-White before they head off to the Olympics in Tokyo. Rachel Malcolm joins us now from her car. Rachel, we'll come to you first, just on reflection for the Six Nations match at the weekend for Scotland. Obviously not the result that you or anybody wanted, so just to get your thoughts on the game. And also, you're on commentary as well, so you probably you have a lot to kind of think about and digest from that game. But yeah, what's your take on it then?
Yeah, I think it was disappointing. I don't think, and I know the girls in camp haven't kind of shied away from the fact that it wasn't a good enough performance. And I think it's almost one of those kind of, I don't want to say rock bottom moments, but it's kind of one of those real moments where you probably stop and have a bigger look at your game, mm-hmm. Both individually and as a team, which is what the girls have done this week, which has probably been, you know, sometimes these games, as awful as they are to go through in terms of having a disappointing performance, they really do kind of kickstart a bit of something different. So I think, you know, it was a bad day for different aspects of the game. I think our set piece didn't function as well as it has done, which is usually a bit of a strength, and Italy really capitalised on that. They scored, I think, two of their tries off lost Scotland set piece. And, you know, Italy actually played really well. So it was a combination of things, and I think disappointing performance. So I think from that looking forward, I think the girls will be looking just to, you know, the big aim going into this week will be the performance and improving on different aspects of the game.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's it can become really quite valuable, a game like that, when the momentum was on the rise, when it was on the up. And it's maybe too harsh to call it a reality check, because you only know the effect it's had the next time you play. And I think in a lot of ways it's fortunate you play 7 days later, obviously Wales this weekend. I think that's a really positive thing. And I'd agree, I think it was a poor start to the game. Kind of lost the kickoff and then didn't really get momentum. The set piece didn't fire. And then tries just before and just after half time were poor ones to concede, that then had a kind of big bearing on that sense that you're always chasing the game, you're always behind, your set piece not functioning that well, you've not had a huge amount of possession, you've had a few turnovers against as well. So it was a tough afternoon. But what I would say, that's the first thing I'd say, and I totally agree with you, Rachel, on the honest assessment of the performance, but I do like how Italy play. Take a step back, as a fan, as a spectator, it was really refreshing to see a team just play.
And they just keep the ball alive, don't they?
Yeah, not really get too influenced by structure or system, which some teams need. Some teams probably don't need as much of that. In all honesty, and I think we see rugby the whole time now that is dominated by system and structure. But it was quite refreshing to see a team that just almost, it looked to me as if they were quite instinctive in how they were playing. Their flat attack was excellent. Big number six was a brilliant ball carrier. 12 was an excellent ball carrier. A bit of gas out wide. So it was I think for me, they were better than I expected. And we were kind of not as good as we hoped would be. So that's probably why the gulf was there. But it's by no means a disaster, because I think it is a reference point to build from.
Yeah. And I think as well, as a squad, we're very hard on ourselves now, which shows the level we're kind of aiming to get to, which is, you know, some of the girls were saying after the game, it felt like a game from 4 years ago or whatever it was, but it absolutely isn't, because, you know, 4 years ago, we probably would have accepted that result as okay, mm-hmm. And accepted that performance. Whereas now the fact that we're challenging that result and that performance is not good enough shows the progress we've made. And, you know, one bad game doesn't define us, and the fact that we know that we're training so much better than what we've put out is, you know, we've got to remember that. And the reality of it is we've played 3 games in a year. So, you know, for any team, that's difficult. Game time aside, actually the whole kind of everything that goes with playing a game and playing an international match as well. So I think, you've got to look at the positives, and, you know, that over the last 2 games, we've had 3 girls get their first caps. Evie Gallagher get her first start last week, playing really, really well, and kind of looking like she's been there for years as well. So, you know, that stuff that goes alongside it is actually a real positive and is something for the future. And yeah, I think there's stuff we can take out of it, and there's areas of the game which were really good. You know, Lisa Thompson played really well from the boot, which you'll be happy with, Mossy. I'm sure you've probably critiqued, even that's me looking at it from a Forest point of view. She kicked the ball really far. It was all right.
that's how I critique it.
So yeah, there's positives there, but like you say, just so lucky that you've got that massive opportunity 7 days later to go out and put it right.
And Mossy mentioned, Rach, that, you know, you do have an opportunity next weekend to right those wrongs. Similar game to expect against Wales. What would be the big difference between this opposition as opposed to last week?
So like Mossy says, Italy notoriously and very much so this season play very kind of heads up rugby, keep the ball alive, always looking for extra passes. Whereas with Wales, you probably see a more direct game. They tend to carry through their forwards. They've got a good 10 in Elson O'Sill, so probably see a bit more kicking in terms of exits. You know, Italy always look to play even if they're on their try line or in their 22, whereas Wales have, you know, quite a set kicking game as well, so probably see them exiting and a bit more kicking to and from. But from a forwards point of view, I think you'll see a bit more direct carrying. I think in terms of how Scotland will look to play, we'll look to start faster, start quicker and probably kind of retain a bit more possession and play a little less structured, I would imagine, to try and get outside of Wales's kind of pack and get backs running at backs.
I mean, there was a couple of kind of nice pieces of attack from Scotland that I think they could just have been a bit flatter on the outside. I thought some of the fix the defence well. Now, if Wales do come up quick, there should be space on that edge, and almost got away two or three occasions against Italy, but then a turnover came. So it was almost as if you're doing a lot of hard work to set the position or set the picture as you want to see really as an attacking team against the defence, but either just that without playing, as you say, that ball retention and contact, or even just that I suppose flow or feeling of being either too flat or too deep. I thought at times or maybe just a wee bit too deep out wide. Yeah. Having done the hard work to create space, couldn't capitalise on it. But as you say, two games in a year.
Yeah.
These are the type of things without exposure. Match fitness is one thing, but it's actually match sharpness, isn't it?
Yeah.
Getting that understanding. And I do think, well, hopefully this weekend we'll have more possession and more opportunity to get that right. And you know, we'd expect that the performance is better and hopefully, especially at home, pick up a win.
As I mentioned at the start, yeah, you were on commentary, you know, Mossy, Chris.
Good job.
Yeah, good job indeed. and Mossy's done loads of commentary. I've done one game, a Highland, I think, versus Carrick in BT Cup final, and I was so bad I got taken off at half time. But how much did you enjoy that whole experience doing that at the weekend?
It was such a surreal experience in that, like, I'm sure Mossy can relate. I think because obviously I still play and have literally just come out of that whole bubble that I've been in for like 3 months to then go to being this neutral kind of watcher. So I kind of had to just dissociate with my team for 80 minutes because it is difficult. But it was, do you know what? It was like, it made the experience of obviously missing the game and the disappointment with that, you know, turned it into something different and got a new experience from it. It's definitely more challenging probably than I anticipated, but yeah, no, it was good fun. It was really good fun. I enjoyed it, and getting another go at it this weekend, so we'll see how we go.
I deserve it. It was good. Well, it's not easy, as you say. It's not easy just even someone as simple as using nicknames or Christian names.
Yeah, that's the
when you're in.
I don't think I've ever that. Yeah, I don't think I've ever called Helen Nelson Helen in my entire life. And because obviously she was captaining, she, you know, kicks her points, and she was someone that I talked about a lot. And like, it just was the most unnatural thing to say Helen. And at one point I did call her Nelly. But I think other than that, I kept the nickname to a minimum. But I did get told off at halftime for saying we too many times.
It's
difficult.
You're right, though, about it. Now, it'll never fill the void of playing. It can't, because it's different. But actually, there's a nervousness around that you have to prepare. You're in the moment. There's a lot of similarities between that and playing. That when you are injured or you're recently retired, it actually helps that feeling of, if you're totally detached from the game and you're sitting on your sofa at home or wherever you are, it makes it harder.
Yeah, 100%.
Like, to move on. And I do think, although it's a difficult thing to do, it's great still to be involved in. You'll don't know, go well again this week.
Yeah, let's hope so.
There's also some more rugby this weekend as well, with the start, I guess, of the Rainbow Cup. Both Glasgow and Edinburgh will be in action this weekend. Mossy, I'll come to you first on that. You know, yes, it's the same teams are playing, I guess, in the Pro 14, but do you expect a different type of game? And do you maybe expect or hope to see teams maybe try something different because it is a kind of a new tournament as such, or what do you expect from this weekend?
Well, I think there's a as we spoke with the referees earlier on, there's three new law variations that will instantly create changes, and the ways to negotiate them, and basically how your tactics might even be influenced in terms of attacking kicks into the goal line, whatever, all the things we spoke about earlier. So that'll make an instant change. The other thing that is potentially could make a change is the time of year. You know, usually you're into the better weather. It might influence more running rugby or the ability to play a bit more running rugby, or it might give the onus to the, if it is dry, the onus to attack that's actually with that half second quicker, there's less chance for the defence to blitz. So you might get changes like that. I also think it's an opportunity to see new players and different players. I think a lot of the teams will look at as a stepping stone or a head start on next season as well in terms of players. And a brilliant opportunity to pick up experience for maybe some that haven't played. But who knows? I mean, you've got potential British and Irish Lions and South African cap players who'll be going head-to-head in different coloured jerseys in a couple of months, probably going head-to-head in their club jerseys. So that's a brilliant opportunity to see the early form, for players to play alongside, for fans to watch. So I think it's obviously starting with reasonably derby-ish games. Obviously Edinburgh play Zebra and then Benetton play Glasgow, but then thereafter we've got two derbies in a row, so there'll be a lot of familiarity but maybe some changes as well.
Here's a question for you both then, just picking up on Mossy's point around players are going to be coming together. The Lions announcement on the 6th of May, fast forward a little bit, so say you're a player and you've been selected for Scotland duty or for Lions duty, and then you've still got to play in these club games, or in the back of your mind you've got this coming up. How does that affect you as a player? You know, Rach, if you're already, made the Scotland squad but you're down playing for Loughborough, and Mossy, yeah, same, if you're playing club rugby but you've been selected for something else, it must have an impact mentally on you. Or are you guys so good that you can just put that to one side and concentrate on the task in hand? How does it affect you as players, this kind of noise in and around the game?
It's a tough one. There's like different strands to it. I think once you get out there and you're playing for your club, it has no effect, if I'm honest, as soon as you get going. I think one thing that I think is probably always in the back of your mind as a player is if you've got something big coming up, is, you know, the injury risk of playing and stuff like that. For me, that's something that is something I would think about personally. But I think, you know, it depends as well on the season. You know, if the boys have had a season where, you know, they've been kind of to-ing and fro-ing, playing a million games in a season, and sometimes you are a little bit like, geez, oh, like, I need a break. But I think with the nature of this year being quite disjointed and, you know, the opportunity actually to get to play rugby, I think has kind of changed people's outlook on it, and, you know, just the kind of gratitude to be playing and enjoying it. I don't think, you know, you are too distracted by what's in the future. You're just focused on what's in the present.
Yeah, I think similar. I think no matter what's happening in the world, what's around the corner, what game you're playing, who you're playing for, there's always stuff off the field that can take your eye off the ball. There's always, if you look for something to influence how you're going to play or how you feel or what might happen if A, you do A and B happens, what if C happens and D doesn't. Like, there's always that going on in everybody's lives all the time. So all it is now is with the kind of situation you talk about there, Jamie, where like a Lions or an international tour or an announcement, or it's just more, as you say, noise around it. And every other time of the year, every other game of the year, and I'm sure all the other players are the same, there's that noise going around, but it's only around at the moment you're not playing. And the only time it isn't there is when you're actually on the field playing, engrossed in the moment. And I think that's where, like, what I would say is, like, you're always aware of it, but when, I suppose, as supporters or media or whatever we are, outsiders looking in, the time where you expect the player to be thinking about it most is the only time where they're totally not thinking about it, because you're dealing with what's in hand right in the moment, right in the minute. You don't have time on the field to worry about getting hurt or worry about making a poor decision that might, you know, allow you to be picked or not picked for a tournament or whatever. You don't have time for that. You do have time for that in the morning of the game when you're in your hotel room on your own thinking, what if this. Yeah. But the moment that matters, you're totally focused, you're on it. And it's a funny one. It is really, I hope I've kind of described it as best I can, because it matters when it doesn't matter, if that makes sense. And when people think it is going to matter, it's the furthest thing from your memory, because there's, or your mind, because there's no space for it. I've probably just confused you. Everybody.
No, not at all.
No, I think that was it. That you got it spot on.
Really?
Yeah. I think I know what you mean. I think I know what you mean.
Cheers, Jamie. I think you do. Right?
I'll go back and listen to this again, but I'll to understand. But I
maybe two or three times.
No, I understand from your point of view that when we, as you know, I can say this because I'm a spectator. I'm somebody who watches the game.
An ex-player. The game.
Mm. Thank you. Yeah, I won't go through my credentials, but there's a lot. But I am. Yeah, I think, if it's a big game, I think, was that player thinking about that? And I remember a game a few years ago, must have been 2017, when it was Hoggy and Tommy Seymour were selected for the Lions. And then I think the week before they were going to go, or 2 weeks before, they played a game at Scotstoun. And all the focus was on them. Everybody's, even the game was going ahead, you're watching Hoggy and Tommy as a fan to go, how are they going to play? And they're probably thinking nothing of it, but us as fans are watching with... So I completely understand where you're coming from, Mossy, from... You know, I'll look at it in a different way that you and Rachel will, because you're players. So good insight, though. Good insight. I thought I'd end that very abruptly. Well, Rach, Mossy, some other news around the game in Scotland sees Alistair Dickinson, a.k.a. Dicko, returning to Glasgow Warriors as scrum coach. He's currently at Bristol Bears, but he will be moving up to Glasgow for next season. Now, I know you both have experience working and playing with Dicko. Rach, he did some stuff with women, didn't he, a few years ago? So you must know Dicko quite well.
Yeah, he worked with us for, I think, maybe two seasons. Quite recently, and yeah, he's fab. He's a brilliant scrum coach. He made a massive difference for us in the time he was with us, and I think you're kind of seeing the fruits of that at the moment, with our scrum being in a lot better place than it has been in previous seasons. But he's quite a dry character in terms of his humour. You never quite knew if he was actually joking or not, but we really enjoyed working with him, and definitely a good appointment for Warriors.
Yeah, it's great to see come back to Scotland. Obviously spent most of his playing days at Edinburgh, played at Gloucester as well. It was a brilliant prop and kind of fame for the kind of Dickinson Ford Nell trio at Edinburgh in the last decade, really, that basically no one could move. It was almost one of the best kind of combinations going around, scrum wise, for a long time. And he's a real student of that, because he played both sides of the scrum when he was younger. Probably when he was younger, it was perceived that the scrummaging wasn't the strongest part of his game. He was really dynamic, he was really quick. I think he was the quickest over 10 metres quite often in the speed test, and just this ball of muscle, this explosive muscle. So, like, scrumming, this sounds strange, but probably wasn't natural to him. So he learned it through his experiences and his kind of always, well, he became one of the best loose heads in the game, really. And he's carried that on through his coaching with the academy, the Fosbrook Academy at Edinburgh, and the under-20s and the Scotland women, and his Bristol Bears as well. So the other great thing is scrum, Rachel, no more me, develops and evolves every year, within every season. It evolves so quickly. To have someone so recently exposed to it and kind of play through the biggest transition in the scrum in terms of the call and sequence and the system and the intricacies, coaching, all this young coach, that's a real benefit to have all that. So I think it's a great appointment for Dicko in Glasgow.
I must say, just on Dicko, was he then, I know, because he kind of had a similar kind of trajectory to you with club rugby. You were both at Edinburgh, you went to Gloucester. I think, was he at Gloucester the same time as you as well?
Yeah,
does he play with you at Gloucester?
And Strokosh, was Al Strokosh as well. So yeah, and Rory Lawson was down there as well. So yeah. Good to have a friendly face. But he was, wherever he's played, whatever side of the scrum, international as well, he was his top, top player. And as I say, he's his own man, Dicko. I know what Rachel says about his dry sense of humour. He can be droll, but his own man, and he makes really strong decisions. He's really principled. And I think it's, as I said before, a really good appointment.
That's all from us this week on the official Scottish Rugby podcast. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, we'll be back next week with more exclusive content.